Hello, my lovelies. Welcome back to another edition of Hey, How'd You Get That Music Job? I am your host, Elle Ariel, and we can be found at musicjobspodcast.com. That's musicjobs with an S, podcast.com. We're also on all the streaming platforms, iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher Podcasts, iHeartRadio, and more. If you are listening to us on one of those podcast streaming platforms, we would love if you could give us some stars, show us some love, give us some feedback so we can get up higher in the rankings, more people can find out all about our little podcast, because we are all about talking to the movers and shakers and innovators, all people from all very talented individuals, I should say, from every aspect of the music business. We talk to them all about career trajectories, about what decisions they made, what obstacles they face, how exactly did they get to where they are at today. So all the episodes are actually on the website musicjobspodcast.com. If you want to go back and listen, I'm sure there is a music job that you are interested in that chances are we have it on the website. So last episode, I spoke with Danelle Harvey. She is a woman that wears many, many hats. She is a female music entrepreneur. She was a pop star in her own right in the UK. She is an indie label founder. She is a lawyer. She is a book author with a book about the music business. Just so much more that I can't even cover. You can find out exactly what she is up to by going back and listening to that episode. Just a lot of really good nuggets of wisdom and a very inspiring story. So again, I urge you to go back and listen to the last episode if you haven't had a chance to already. So this week, I'm very pleased to welcome to the podcast Ben McLean. He is an attorney specializing in the music industry and the music business. He has had decades of experience. He has participated in incredible projects, everyone from Beyonce to Jay-Z and more. So this is going to be a really fun episode. He's going to talk all about his career as a lawyer and more. But before we do that, we're going to get started with one of his favorite tracks. Here is She Said from the band Half Noise. Here we go. For joining me on Hey, How'd You Get That Music Job?
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Tell me about childhood. Tell me about your first memories of music.
I've always been a music lover, mostly by listening to the radio. But when I was a little kid, I guess like anybody's parents would listen to records and listen to the radio, and I would hear whatever they were listening to, they were controlling what I was hearing. And in those days, it was, you know, my parents were into more like soft rock or orchestrated music or whatever, but I would hear things, and you know, it at least introduced me to music and melodies and things like that. And then when I was probably in elementary school, I had an older sister, and she would, back in those days, people would buy 45s, you know, like singles, and play them on a record player. This was pre-CD, so she would play some things, and I would hear them, and she'd buy albums, and I'd look at them, and you know, the albums were cool because of the artwork and all that stuff, which you don't really see as often, although albums I know are kind of making a comeback. But when I was growing up, that was the standard format that everybody bought, was an album. So, and then I started listening to the radio a lot myself. So, yeah, I was just hearing things that I liked. And then I just sort of became a music junkie. I don't know why. I wasn't really musically talented, although when I was a kid, I did took piano lessons and guitar lessons and played guitar a little bit, like at church and for fun, but I never was really that good at it. But music I loved, and I became sort of a trivia buff, where I would want to know who wrote the song, who produced the song, who was in the group. You know, I'd listen to American Top 40 and always excited to hear like what was going to be in the top 10 and even maybe what was in the top 30 or 40, not even in the top 10 songs you wouldn't hear as much. That was just interesting to me. So at some point I just decided, hey, I'd like to work in music. But I grew up in Kansas, right? There's no business there. I didn't have any connections in the business. So I was going to college, and I one day I just decided, well, how am I going to get in the music business? I'm not a musician per se, and I don't really know anybody. So, but I did know that there was executives that worked in the business, accountants, lawyers, managers, things like that. I actually wanted to be a manager. So I started reading about that and how you do that. And there's really not a lot of, there really wasn't a lot of materials out there in those days about things. This is pre-internet, how you be a manager or what. So, but I did figure if I went to law school, it might be a good entree to get into the business, especially if I went in one of the entertainment centers, LA, New York, or Nashville. And I didn't want to go to New York. It was too cold and dark, really, and kind of scary because I hadn't really been there much, and it just seemed too big. And then I wasn't really into country music per se, and so LA seemed more like the obvious place to go. So I came out here to go to law school thinking I would use that as a way to get into being an artist manager, and I did that for a while, but it was tough because when you're a manager, you only make money if your client makes money. You make a commission. So I really wasn't surviving that way, and I was really just learning the business, really, because when you're a manager, you do everything. At least, I mean, I wasn't working for a big company. I was just kind of doing it on my own. So, you know, I was the PR person, the roadie, the record promoter, the shopper, trying to get the deal, and you know, the babysitter, everything. So you learn a lot when you're a manager because you have to touch every aspect of the business. So that was good training, but at some point, I just decided to focus on the law because that's something I could actually get paid to do, and so that's really how I ended up being a music lawyer. Now I'm an entertainment lawyer, but my focus is music. But it really just started by, you know, loving music and wanting to work with artists primarily.
Yeah, I want to back up a little bit because I think it's kind of fascinating. I always love hearing different approaches to music. So the word that came to mind was almost like reverse engineering, that you were taking, you know, you'd hear a song or something, maybe an artist that you really liked, and then you would figure out who was the producer, who, you know, who played on this track. Like, it sounds like you kind of...
Well, in those days, you really had to buy the record to see all this, mm-hmm. you know, and or you could buy a Billboard magazine, but where I lived, you couldn't go to the newsstand and get that, so you'd have to order it or something. It was very expensive, so I think I pretty much just would have to buy a 45 or an album and look at the credits. And that's how I learned. And there may have been a few books, and there were in those days about, you know, people that it's not like now there's so many books and everybody writes a book, but I think in those days, yeah, it was just me and I loved music and it really wasn't that expensive to buy a single or something if you mm-hmm. really liked it, but instead of just listening to the music, which was primarily what I was doing for some reason, I really wanted to know all that other information too. And it's actually been helpful because when I first came out here, which was 30 years ago, a lot of those people from the 60s, 70s and 80s were still in the business that had created the business kind of. So I met a lot of them and worked for a lot of them. And some of them I still do. A lot of them aren't in the business anymore, but it was good to kind of already know a little bit about, because I found that, you know, people, if you know something about their history or if you've taken the time to study somebody, they appreciate it a lot more when you talk to them, or, you know, because they know you've put in the time and you really care about it. You know what I mean? I think at least that worked in my favor. And also when I first came out here too, I did a lot of writing to meet people. I was practicing law, but on the side, there were like magazines. You could go to the Whiskey or the Viper Room in those days and Troubadour, and there'd be a bunch of free magazines just laying out there on the floor. You could pick them up. That would talk about the mm-hmm. local scene, who's playing mm-hmm. where. But they also had people would write columns. So I had a legal column in a couple of those, just where I would, you know, give legal advice or whatever. But I also would do interviews of people in the business. So I met a lot of people even doing that on the side, which wasn't necessarily legal, but it was just ways. It gave me a calling card to meet people and develop relationships. So That was just something unique that I did, you know, that these days I would never have time to do that, but back then I did.
Yeah. And I think, again, it was sort of, it was a different audience and more of a captive audience because.
Well, and by the way, I was not getting paid and I wasn't getting right. paid for that. I was doing it all for just to learn the business. And that's the thing. I think a lot of people, you know, it kind of sucks really, but at the beginning of your career, a lot of times you do have to do a lot of things for free or volunteer or intern or whatever, just to get your foot in the door. I'm not saying, and if you, you know, everybody should be paid, don't get me wrong, but I've just found in this, the entertainment business, a lot of times at the very beginning, you may have to do that. And some people may not want to do that, but that's just a tough pill to swallow. But that's just been my experience, because people just assume if you're young and you want to work in the business, you're like an intern, you know, unpaid.
No, absolutely. I want to ask, though, to put it kind of bluntly, like, why did you become a lawyer? Like, it's not, as you know, a sort of conventional career track for somebody who wants to be involved in the music business. Like, what was the motivation for you to go into law?
Well, like I said, the original motivation was to get the law degree as a calling card or credential to be able to maybe work as a music business executive at a label or a manager or something, as opposed to actually practicing law. And when you go to law school, unfortunately, you're required to take all the same courses that everybody else does, trial work and tort law and criminal law and all this kind of, which I was not interested in. I certainly didn't want to be a trial attorney where you go into court and argue and object and all that. I wasn't interested in that at all, but you have to do all that stuff to go to law school. So I learned how to do all that stuff and I did some of it, but yeah, I had no interest in being like a traditional lawyer. Like most people think you go into courtroom and battle with people, but actually most lawyers work behind the scenes and are what you'd call more transactional, which is what I do more of, deal with contracts and things and give people advice and consultations. And I know a lot of people, so I can hook people up and I've helped people get deals and things because I have relationships, but I never go to court. So I never had any intention of doing that. It was really just more of a way to be taken seriously because I was coming out of nowhere. I didn't have any family in the business or friends in the business or any experience in the business. So who was going to hire me? So I kind of just had to make, and when I first started practicing, it really was kind of just a temporary thing, I thought, to maybe build up some clientele and then maybe ease in and work at a record label or something like that, or a bigger firm. But it never really worked out, or at least not on my timetable. So I just ended up developing my own practice. You know, over time, it just kind of happened that way. And then once you're your own boss for a while, you don't really want to work for anybody else. Right. You can control it. Yeah, it's so different when you work for a big law firm. They're like, it's very authoritative. You know, they stand over you and crack the whip and make you bill so many hours a week, or you get fired and they don't pay you much, at least not at the beginning. Or you could have a big clientele and go into a bigger firm and they might steal your clients. They hire you, you merge with them, and then they fire you or whatever. So I just didn't want that to ever happen to me. So, and I don't know, I'm just telling you, those are the negatives. There's obviously lots of positives about working at a bigger law firm. I certainly encourage young lawyers that they probably should work at a bigger firm and have a mentor so they can kind of learn the ropes and not have to learn it all on their own. Cause I kind of learned it all on my own, really. I mean, I did have some mentors, but they weren't like at the desk right next to me, you know? So,
right.
So there was a lot of trial and error in how I did it, but anyway, yeah. There's not one way on how to get to the end zone, really. But yeah, I don't know. I just thought going to law school was a way to at least get a credential and have some respectability. But also it was a way to earn money, because you can always earn money as a lawyer doing something. Whereas if you're just a manager or something, like I said before, you know, it's hard. You know, anybody can be a manager. You don't have any. There's no credentials for that. But it's just like if your client's not making any money, you aren't either. And most people don't. Most artists don't make it, unfortunately, or not at the level that, you know, that they can sustain a bunch of people working for them.
Right. Let's talk about that a little bit, though. Tell me about your experience, you know, managing bands. Was it when you started doing it when you were in law school?
Yeah. When I first came out of here. I managed three or four acts.
So how did you do that? Did you approach them or?
Yeah. Just would see somebody or hear. Yeah, I would go to the clubs. I would do it old school. You know, I'd go to clubs and see somebody live. I mean, to me, you have to be great live or it's never going to happen. So to me, that was really important. But I may have heard, I put ads out and I had a P.O. box on Sunset at that time. I didn't even have my own office, really. Or my office was not in Hollywood. So I just had a P.O. box on Sunset and I would take ads in Music Connection or whatever. I was accepting unsolicited material. If you accept unsolicited material, you will get bombarded with material. Now, most of it's probably not competitive enough, But you have to listen. You know, I don't know if the next Beatles is going to send me something. I listen to everything, so I don't want to miss out. So I would find some good things now and then that would excite me. But, you know, a lot of times something's incomplete. You know, you have to really check it out. But I was hoping I'd hear some great songs and see a great live show. And in those days, that should have been enough. You know, and again, this is going way back, pre-internet. Now, because of the internet, you know, people can self-release things, and the labels chase around metrics a lot more, where they want to see that you have X number of friends, X number of likes, X number of streams, whatever it is, which didn't happen. You know, when I first came out here, was based more on gut. You know, artists would have careers, people would take chances on them based on gut. Now it's much more based on statistics. But yeah, that's kind of how I did it. Or people would recommend things to me. It's like now, I mean, I still read aids and listen to the radio, and I have satellite radio, and I like to listen to blogs and things like that for cool new things. But most of the things I find that I get involved with tend to be referred to me by people I know. And that's certainly the way it is at the record labels. They don't really take anything from anybody they don't know. They have a group of people that they deal with, and they like to get personal recommendations. So that's why I've spent a lot of my career basically just developing relationships. It's pretty important.
Yeah, talk about that. Talk about kind of your first, you know, you've got your law degree, and what were kind of your first steps in your career?
Well, you have to find clients, paying clients. So I networked like crazy. You know, went to every free event you could go to, you know, because in this town, LA, every night there's something going on. There's bands playing, there's seminars going on, there's conferences, there's networking, there's openings, art openings. But anything that I got invited to, I would tend to go to, or I would try to find out when BMI or ASCAP was putting on an event or a Grammy event or wherever. Hopefully it was free, but, you know, sometimes you might have to pay a minimal thing, or I would go to South by Southwest, things like that, that it does cost money, but if you really plan it out properly, you can get a lot out of an experience like that, and you meet a lot of people. So I spent a lot of time just trying to meet people and network, and you know, pass my card out and just tell them I'm available to work. And you know, you start at the bottom, and you have clients that can't pay you very much, or you might help other lawyers that have some overflow work, which I did as well. You know, that maybe it wasn't as exciting as maybe you'd like it to be, but at least would keep the rent paid while you could sort of establish the career you wanted to do. So it was a lot of that. And then eventually you get a client or two that actually has a career and gets on the radio or gets a record deal. And then one thing sort of leads to another from there. I mean, yeah, there's that's sort of how it worked for me. And it's still like that. I mean, I still have to hustle like crazy to maintain relations, because there's always new people coming in and out of the business, and just trying to stay relevant and trying to stay on top of what's hot and what's current, which is hard now because things really change so fast. Yeah. But luckily for me, though, since I'm a lawyer, I'm really I'm handling people's contracts, giving them legal advice. Now, it's good to know the kind of music they make and stay current on that. But people don't really expect me to be like an A&R person, or maybe even a manager, where I'm supposed to necessarily be an expert on any particular genre. So, because people really look to me more to protect them, make sure I'm not getting ripped off, and to know the business side of things. So I, you know, I read every book and every magazine I can, article about, you know, law and current trends and things like that. It's just so I can stay on top of, because that's what people expect from me, is to know the music.
So when you were first starting out, were you also managing, or was it just still serving as their lawyer?
Well, yes. Yeah. But I can tell you, sometimes when you're working with an artist early in their career, they may not have a manager yet, or they may not have a booking agent yet, or a PR person or anything. So a lot of times I'd be the lawyer, but I was almost filling other roles, not necessarily booking people, but certainly kind of acting as a quasi-manager, because you're sort of like a sounding board. And a lot of times lawyers are the first person involved with an artist. Maybe you're just helping them do a contract or something, but it develops into you become, you know, somebody that they trust and an advisor before they get a manager. Because being a manager is like on all, you know, 365 day a year kind of a gig when you're looking over somebody's career. Me, not so much. You know, sometimes I have clients I might talk to every couple of days, or maybe just once a year. But when you're a manager, it's like all the time. You know, I would say it just kind of varies. Although these days I'd prefer just to kind of fill the manager role. But earlier in my career, I maybe was more open to, because, you know, there was a time, like I said, where I really wanted to be a manager. So I didn't even mind so much if people were leaning on me for other things. But then at some point, you just get too busy for that, because artists, and I'm not saying this in a bad way, but they can be very, very needy, you know, so, and you, that's why it's, they need to have a good manager that can really devote the proper time to them for things like that.
So you're serving as a lawyer, and obviously you're, during your tenure, it was, you know, when I think back to like the 90s and the 2000s, and everything sort of just started getting super crazy, and Napster and MySpace and, you know, all these things sort of like blew up and then died. And what was, can you talk about your experience with that? Like trying to sort of navigate the legal ramifications during that real tumultuous time, which is probably still happening.
Well, two things I can say. I mean, 10 years ago, 2008, well, and Napster was before that. Napster was, you know, 1999 through early 2000s. But when music, the, but it sort of came to a head in 2008, as far as I get, because the whole market crashed across the board. Mm-hmm. But music was at its lowest point, because everybody was, nobody was paying for music in mid, late 2000s. And there hadn't, the streaming hadn't really kicked in yet. And it, I mean, no, and it was just really bad. And labels were laying off their whole staffs, and nobody had any money. And it hadn't really gotten to, you know, a lot of these platforms now that artists can utilize really had, like Facebook and YouTube hadn't really kicked in yet. So it was kind of a dreary time as far as that goes. But I, and you know, because I mean, when I first got in the business, you could go into Sony Records, and every office was filled. You could hear music coming out of every office. There were people walking in the hallways. There was excitement. Everybody was there. It was just magic in the air. And then like 10 years ago, you'd go to the same building and maybe three quarters of the offices were empty and you had no music, you know, because everybody had gotten laid off and everybody, there were all these cutbacks. It was, you know, so it was kind of gloomy really. So, and then the people that really hung in there were, at least on the business side, were the people that really wanted to work in the business, myself included. Because the money kind of dried up for a while, so as far as paying bills and getting, you know, commissions and things like that. But I mean, it's it, but it, you know, everything, the internet's really created a lot of great opportunities. And with the cell phone, of course, it's global. There's billions of people now consuming music, which before was much more fragmented, more U.S. centric versus Europe or whatever. So all those are positives. But I can tell you, like MySpace, the second thing I was going to say was MySpace. At the time, that was a great platform. I discovered a lot of amazing artists on MySpace. In fact, one of my current clients is a girl named Ellie Duyer. She's on RCA, and she just had two hit records as a feature, featured vocalist with Zed, who's a huge DJ, and Griffin, who's a pretty big up-and-coming DJ. But I think combined on the two tracks, they have 100 million views on YouTube, and I don't know what the streaming is. It's quite massive. She's the featured vocalist on those. But I found her on MySpace 10 years ago when she was like 15 or 16. She was putting tracks up, and I just discovered her that way, and I've worked with her ever since. You know, and it was just a few years ago she finally got a record and publishing deal. But she has an amazing voice. But and then probably around that same time, I found a group that they were called Outer Space Politicians at the time, but it was three kids in their bedroom, teenagers, and they were just amazing, I thought. They looked great. They sounded great, pop songs. And then I stayed in touch with them, and they, within a year's time, they hooked up with a manager who I also knew, coincidentally, between all of us together, and they changed their name to All Star Weekend. They got signed to Disney, and they became a pretty big boy band at the time. This is, again, you know, 8-9 years ago. But, you know, when you're a Disney artist, you kind of get in that bubblegum box, and they kind of outgrew it eventually. But I found them on, that. The point is, I found them on MySpace. So, I mean, I, in those days, I thought MySpace was pretty cool. That's just an example of, I use that platform to my advantage. Of course, now, you know, I do the same thing with YouTube and Spotify and other things. I really like YouTube, though, because you can see the visual. You can see everything there because you can see the live, and if somebody's doing live, but I like to see a visual element to the music. I think most people do. So, I mean, I don't know. You just kind of ride the waves as they come along, you know. Mm-hmm. I can't say I'm an expert at anything necessarily on a technological level, but I'm just, I just try to, I just know the basics, so that's good enough for me.
Yeah, you know what's up. So I want to talk to you a little bit about labels, because I think now you obviously as an artist can be independent and you're no longer reliant on getting that super amazing record deal to be successful. But I think also like labels throughout the years have in some cases gotten kind of a bad rap for, you know, like taking advantage of artists and specifically with contracts and trying to control their music, et cetera. I'm wondering if you can speak to that from your client side and maybe how that has changed or not changed over the years.
Well, I think labels definitely have their place. I mean, historically, I mean, going all the way back, Beatles, Bob Dylan, whatever, just Rolling Stones, they were all on record labels. And in those days, no internet, so you had to be on a record label to blow up. Of course, when the internet came along, I mean, the hope was you could cut out the labels and the distributors, and you still can to an extent, but I found that if you really want to be a big star, a big pop star, you really need the backing of a label at some point, because they have all the juice, they have the staff, the marketing, promotion, they're worldwide, they've got the template, they've been doing it for 50 years, whatever, you know, and they've got the leverage to break somebody. Now, if you're a niche artist like bluegrass or gospel or something, maybe you don't need that as much. But I think the internet's great to be an independent artist, and some artists are fine to just take it to a certain point, and they're comfortable that way, and they make a living, and they can control their destiny, and they don't have to worry about it. But if you really want to be the next Rihanna or Katy Perry or whatever, you're going to have to be on a major label. I don't know any way around it, because even these people like Chance the Rapper or whatever, when they say that they did, or Macklemore, when they say they did it independently, if you really dig deep, they're not. There's people behind the scenes helping them, either corporate or there's distributors behind the scenes that are funding those things. And it's more of a perception where the perception is they're indie, but they're not completely doing it on their own, completely independent. So I just don't think it's possible to be huge yet without a label at some point. Now, it's probably going to happen at some point, but I don't have an issue with labels, but it comes down to, you know, our creative control issues and things like that you brought up. They tend to, if you're a new artist and you haven't had a hit before, they do invest a lot of money, minimum hundreds of thousands. They were talking about major labels here. Independence wouldn't be that much, but a major label is going to spend minimum a couple $100,000, could be millions to break an artist. So it's a lot of risk, and there's no guarantee of any return. So that's why they insist on having final say and locking people up for multiple albums and things like that. But you know, the trade-off is you could become a superstar. So of course most people don't, but that's always, everybody thinks they will. And you know, why would you do it if you didn't have that faith? So I don't, and there's good and bad. And I think it's a case by case thing, but in a perfect world, you'd self-release something with the mentality that you're just going to be independent. And that's the way you roll. And that's the way you think. And then you get to a certain point where people approach you and they're like, hey, we have an opportunity for you to upstream, or we could partner up with you or whatever. Are you interested? Well, then you have all the leverage at that point, and you can decide what you want to do, stay independent or be funded or be a joint venture or be totally signed. So you're the master of your own fate a lot more at that point than, you know, because when I first got in the business, like when I was managing bands, you'd have to make a tape, take a picture, and maybe play a showcase at the Viper Room or Whiskey or something, and hope and pray somebody would come and like it. And right. That was it, you know, right. And then they either liked it or they didn't. And it was, you know, but now you can control that a lot more because you can self-release content, and you know, and it's ridiculous if you don't. You should, you have to, because if you don't, it almost makes it seem like you're not a serious artist to me, if you haven't put anything out on your own. So I don't know if that really answers your question or muddies the waters, but it's always case by case. But I think in the big picture, if you really want to be a big star, make tons of money and go all over the world, you probably do need to affiliate with a label. It's not necessarily a bad thing. I look at it as a partnership, and that's something as a lawyer guy that I try to help people make the fairest deals they can. And you always try to build something in the contract. If the label doesn't do their job, you can leave. You know, those are the kind of things that lawyers help negotiate.
Yeah. And speaking of that, do you find that does the internet give the artist more leverage nowadays than they had before?
Well, it all completely depends on if the artist is making any noise. Because if, you know, if you've released three videos and you have a million views combined, that's impressive. And the label's going to be interested in that. If you release three videos and have 15 views, they're going to think there's something wrong with this. And they're going to dismiss it. So it's good and bad. So I don't know why things go viral. It's like the cat videos or whatever. Why, you know, but versus somebody super talented and make a great record and nobody listens to it. It's like you scratch your head. But I guess you have to hope if you have a hit song, it's going to rise out. It's going to somehow cut through the noise. And the problem is, it's like sand on the beach. There's so much out there. How do you break through? I don't really know, you know, but that's why I think it's good to have continuous content flow, because at least then you have a little, it's like, you know, casting a wider net that way, that people are going to hear you, discover you, whatever. And you have to be on all the platforms and you have to be everywhere. So yeah, I mean, it's definitely it's to the artist's advantage to have the internet, but on the other hand, if people aren't reacting to you on the internet, then labels will use that against you.
It's sort of a double-edged sword, isn't it? Because yeah, you know, you have leverage, but it still comes down to how big is your fan base.
Well, and it's not completely like that. I mean, I've had meetings and I've gotten artists signed in the last couple of years where they didn't have big numbers, but they were great. They were great. And we found ways to portray that where you had visual content or just an interesting story. And I think whenever I'm working with an artist and helping them get a deal, I always take them into the meeting where they can like interact with the A&R people and maybe even perform live acoustically or whatever, or just show off their personality. Because that's really what people really do want, somebody who's interesting and a great personality, as well as being a great musician, singer, writer, whatever. I think you have to have a great personality. A lot of times that doesn't come across unless they get to meet you in person. So I found that that's helpful but of course the icing on the cake is that you have big numbers too. But I think the good thing is, because of streaming coming in and sort of giving the labels a little more money again, because they have these catalogs of songs. That's why they're making a lot of money. They have millions of songs streaming, so they're making money. If you have one song streaming, it doesn't make anything, but they have money again to play with. So I think they're taking chances again on things. Whereas 10 years ago in that down period I was telling you about, they tightened up so much that they just wouldn't sign anything unless it was a sure thing. And of course, nothing's a sure thing, but they had to really see things firing on so many cylinders, where now I think it's gone back a little bit more, that if you have potential, it helps. Of course, it's nice if you're connected with a producer they've heard of, or maybe had a sync placement or something on a show where there's at least something or some fan numbers or whatever. I mean, it's nice to have that, but it's not mandatory anymore. Like 10 years ago, I think it was. And then of course, 20, 30 years ago, like I was mentioning, there was no other way, because there could be a rare band that would play on the Sunset Strip and draw 300 people, and that's impressive. But for the most part, you know, they were just going off of their gut, and hopefully they heard a hit song. It still comes down to that, I think. You have if somebody hears a hit song, whatever that is, you know, that's what makes the difference. But that's sort of like an opinion based thing. But I think even with that, if you play your song for five people and they all give it a thumbs up, that's a good sign.
Do you feel, working over the years, that you've gotten sort of, I don't know what the word is, better is kind of a cheap way to say it, but sort of more discerning about an artist that's going to be successful?
If an artist would be?
Yeah, like I'm just sort of saying, like, do you feel like over the years you've kind of honed your instincts?
Yeah, you do. Well, because you've seen so much trial and error. You've seen what's made, I mean, in studying this for 30 years or whatever, even longer than that, because before I was in the business, like I said, I was a junkie about music. Right. Just studying all the artists and who made it and who didn't and why they broke up and why they failed or whatever, it's like you kind of file all that away and utilize it. But when I meet with somebody, I mean, there's definitely, you know, you have to have great music, obviously. You have to hopefully, you know, have an interesting look of some sort and have your own unique style and hopefully have a some kind of unique voice. You know what I mean? I mean, when you hear, you know, Neil Young or Bob Dylan, their voices are weird, but it's unique, and that's probably why it works. It's not necessarily, they don't sound like Celine Dion, but they have interesting voices, so there's got to be something like that. But then beyond that, that's the work ethic, you know? Do they have the work ethic? Sometimes that's hard to tell, because when you first meet somebody, they're going to put on their best face. But are they showing up on time? Do they follow up? Do they play out? Do they want to you know, it's hard to be an artist now because you do have to do a lot of social media marketing, which, you know, which who likes to do that? But it's kind of like you want to see that these people are actually making the effort to do it. You don't want to work harder than they do. So those kind of intangible things you learn over the years that, you know, or just, you know, just because some, the people that make it, they tend to, there's just certain traits that they have, you know, there's no guarantee, but so you hope they're checking out, you can tick off as many of those boxes as possible so you have a better shot. Cause yeah, the worst thing in the world, and this has happened to me, where you put a lot of effort into helping develop or shop somebody, and then they either bail on you or they don't follow through or they self, you know, they combust or whatever before they hit the goal line just because, you know, and then it's like a big waste of time, you know, because everybody, nobody was going to get paid until they got paid. It's kind of a thing.
Yeah. Do you feel like artists today have to be entrepreneurs? Do you feel that that's
well, they necessary? Or somebody in the band, like a perfect example is Kiss. In Kiss, you've got Gene Simmons, who's like the ultimate entrepreneur and drags that band around and you know, and makes sure that they've got all these marketing things going on, these branding things going on. But I found with young bands, I'm sure he was like that from day one. You got to have somebody in the band that has that gene, that has the business gene or the drive, the professional, you know, and that's the entrepreneurial gene or whatever. If everybody in the band's like that, great. But it usually is one or two people, or you have to have a manager or somebody on your team that's like that to kind of drag it along. Cause it is a lot of work. It doesn't just sort of happen on its own. In other words, you know? So yeah, I think you do, but you know, it varies as to how far you have to take that because you really have to focus on the music primarily. You know, because otherwise, what are you going to be, you know, pushing if you don't have something amazing to push? So I think sometimes people take their eye off the ball and put too much effort into the business. Or they, you know, I have people come into my office, they've read every law book. I'm like, well, wow. Great. Well, great. But do you have great music? I'm the lawyer, you know, I'm not making the music. You're making the music. But they act like they know more about the law because they've read every book. So it's sort of like, sometimes I wonder if people are taking their eye off the ball. I'm trying to be too entrepreneurial, in other words. But yeah, I think you need to have some of that going on.
Well, that's a good segue to talk about your book.
Okay. It's called Music Business in 10 Easy Lessons. And it's kind of like a for dummies kind of a book, that type of a format, really. I just tried to take the 10 things that I found over the years. It's mostly geared towards new artists, really, that new artists kind of contend with and ask me about and I help people with. And then it's almost just more like a handbook where I just tried to simplify these 10 areas and it's very easy to read and it's not that long and it's on Amazon. It started as an ebook, but then now you can get a paperback copy. It's really on demand. So if you click the paperback column, they'll just mail you a copy. It's not like I have a bunch of, I just self-published it essentially, which you can do these days. At least my first book, I mean, I intend to do more, but this was the first one I did. And you know, so I hope it's helpful to somebody, but yeah, but I appreciate you letting me mention it on the podcast here, but it's definitely geared towards up and coming artists and anybody that wants to kind of learn the music business, kind of just to get a taste of what it's really like, or just some of these basic concepts so you can get your head around the basic things, you know, whether it's a record deal, publishing deal, how you deal with an investor, how you deal with a manager, how you deal with a producer. These are the kind of things that come up over and over and over again. Copyright, trademark.
I think it's actually really important because I think there obviously is so much fixation on the more glamorous aspects of the music business, but you really do kind of need to know the nuts and bolts and exactly what you're getting yourself into, and everything from even just starting out in my own experience, like for example, like pay to play, you know, I know that's not necessarily a legal issue, but it's one of those things. It's like, as an artist, do you want to pay a venue to play there? Like, is that something that you want to, that you're willing to do so that you can get the marquee name in your list of venues type of thing? Just things like that. You also can, a lot of people will, you'll be inundated with people that want to make money from artists with, you know, offers of promotion or this and that, you know what I mean? So I think you can sort of get accosted from all different angles. And I think it's hard to parse out good, solid, reliable, trustworthy information.
Well, it is true. And a lot of that is live and learn. And it's sort of like pay to play. That could be a great thing at the beginning of your career if you don't have an audience yet and you've got to prove to everybody that you're worth it. Maybe that's how you do it. If you can't get a gig any other way, eventually, hopefully, you can move beyond that. But I don't think it's necessarily a ripoff to artists, although I know, you know, I talked to a lot of older artists that used to play in LA before the pay to play days, and they're like, you know, they paid us to play. Well, that's the way it's supposed to be, but it's just changed. You know, the promoters don't want to take risks anymore. But yeah, I mean, you live and learn there. But as far as the ripoff artists that are out there that are preying on artists, hey, pay me this and I'll get you on this Spotify playlist, or I'll get you this many YouTube views or whatever. I don't know. You have to be really wary about some of those things. I mean, just like anything else, the good thing about the internet is, though, now you can check up on anybody. You can find out, you know, do they have bad marks against them? Are people complaining about them? Or do they have good reputations? And I personally wouldn't hire anybody unless I, you know, somebody, you know, that I knew gave them a good recommendation, or I did some research and I could see that they had positive reviews. You know, that stuff didn't exist before. So the internet's good for that. But obviously, I mean, I spent half of my career helping people get out of bad deals and things. So, you know, obviously a lot of times people just, where do I sign? Or they get all excited about something without probably researching it properly.
Did you say, I can't remember, I'm sorry. Did you say that your book also talks about like getting producers?
Well, not so much about how you get them, but how you deal with them. What kind of,
how do you deal with them? Yeah. I think that's important.
Yeah.
I think that's important. Cause that's one story I've heard, I'd say, more frequently than not, is people that they're acoustic and they want to make an album and they don't know how to do it. So they're like, all right, I guess I'll go find this guy as a producer. So, you know, and he doesn't have me sign anything. And he's,
well, you need to, the one thing I can say, just again, as a lawyer, and I don't want to sound overly, you know, lawyerly, I guess, but it's, you should get something in writing every time you work with somebody, because it's just too important, especially with, when you're creating a copyright with somebody, which you are, when you make an audio recording, it's copyright, and a producer is helping you make it, so they basically co-own the recording with you, the master, unless you have them sign off on the rights, giving you the rights. Not that they're not going to get paid and get a royalty and get a credit, but they're not supposed to own it unless, of course, they worked on spec for free or whatever, and then that's a different story. But, you know, but a lot of times, just because you pay somebody, it doesn't mean that you own it 100% under the law. And that's a misconception that causes a lot of problems, you know? So, but yeah, that kind of stuff's in the book, you know, how do you work for hire, and what do you pay producers, what royalties and points and fees and credits. And but the work for hire thing to me is the most important, because you always want to, if there's any advice I can give an artist, you always want to own your rights. If you can, you want to own your songs and your masters. Now, if somebody's paying you a lot of money, like a label, to record it, well, of course they're probably going to own all or part of that, or be your partner on it. But if you're going to self-fund things, you don't be giving your rights away. And obviously, if you own everything, you have more control over what happens to it. So, and that is the great thing about the internet. You can create, or just new technology. I mean, I literally have had artists make, and maybe you've heard the same thing, make records in their bedroom that sound like it could have been made for $1 million. Sometimes it's like, how'd they do it? You know, they just, it's just amazing, you know, so.
Well, how do people find you? What's the best way?
Well, probably, I mean, if you Google my name, a lot of stuff pops up, but I have a website which kind of has everything on it, which is just my name, benmclane.com, BenMclane.com. But I have other social media platforms too, but that's the one that has kind of everything on it. So I always kind of push people to that.
And say the name of your book.
Oh, again. Music Business in 10 Easy Lessons. And right now you can only get it on Amazon. But if you just search that or my name, it pops up. The link pops up. So so I appreciate that, and hopefully somebody will get something out of that if they buy the book.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much. Yeah. I so appreciate you having me on the show today.
Okay, take care.
Again, special thanks to Ben McLean for being on the show. So grateful to have his incredible knowledge of all things music, music business, music law, etc. So again, you can find him at benmclane.com, and the name of his book is The Music Business in 10 Easy Lessons. So make sure you check it out on Amazon and wherever fine books are sold. Okay, kiddies, so thus ends another week of Hey, How'd You Get That Music Job? 2018 is rolling to a close. Again, I am your host, L. Ariel, and I can be found at LARIELmusic.com. That's LARIELmusic.com. I'm also on social media at LARIEL Music, and the podcast is also on social media at Music Jobs Podcast. So go on and follow, say hi, and I will try to follow you back. Okay, my loves, have a wonderful week. You know, holiday shopping, don't let the holiday madness get you down too much. Have some eggnog, or if you're like me, have some lactose-free eggnog. Maybe chill out a little bit, enjoy the Christmas lights, the holiday lights. Okay, my loves, so we are going to keep on hustling. We're going to pursue that dream, and again, we are not going to give up.